Welcome to Smart Citizen. I'm Emily Bowes. I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to Nadine Panisha, who's running for City Council. So excited to have you on. You're actually the first City Council candidate we've talked to on Smart Citizen, so this will be really fun. And can you just dive in, tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to run for City Council?
Sure. So I've been in Virginia Beach for 34 years. I'm a transplant from upstate New York, and I raised a son here and absolutely love Virginia Beach and got involved with the Back Bay Restoration Foundation, which is a nonprofit advocacy group that focuses on preserving and protecting the southern watersheds of Virginia Beach. And once I got involved with that, I was in this like hands-on learning mode about coastal resiliency and flooding and infrastructure and green engineering and all of these things that our city is behind in right now. And so that is what propelled me to decide to finally put my hat in the ring and try to make a difference here in Virginia Beach.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that for people that might not understand? In what ways would you say Virginia Beach is behind, and what can we do to improve?
Okay, so we are, and people don't know this because we always talk about, you know, we're fourth in the nation for sun, and, you know, we're the safest city, you know, and all of those things are fantastic because we're a tourist destination and we have to market ourselves effectively. But what we don't talk about is that we are the 12th most fragile coastal city in the country. And that is strictly because of our geography. Like if you fly over Hampton Roads or Virginia Beach, you'll see water. It's surrounded by water. There's water everywhere. And so our, don't mind me. This is like,
You're good.
So we're surrounded by water. And what has happened is there was a heyday in the 60s and 70s where we just built out sprawl in Virginia Beach without much of a plan, but just built out and didn't really care about the fact that we were building on swampland and marshland and land that served as a natural mitigator for our area, right? So we built over it, paved it, and made ourselves vulnerable to changes in the climate. So now we have reached a point where our neighborhoods are 50 to 60 years old in many cases. So our infrastructure is failing and we haven't invested in that. We have overdevelopment that wasn't built sustainably. It was just built like the 60s and 70s. We weren't thinking about sustainability then. And we have intense weather patterns and they've all collided. And we can't stop Mother Nature, but what we can do is control the things that we as human beings can control. And we're behind on that. For example, stormwater maintenance. Stormwater maintenance, cleaning the storm drains, cleaning the ditches, doing all of the things that we should be doing that you guys pay taxes on, right, is 6 years backlogged.
Oh, wow.
Yes, it's 6 years backlogged. And so when I kept hearing, oh, flooding, we are so passionate about it. We care about it so much every election season. Everyone's passionate about flooding. How do you then become 6 years behind? How does that happen? It's like it's the first thing you would do if you were truly concerned about flooding. You would make sure that you were cleaning your storm drains.
For sure.
So you start unveiling, you know, peeling that onion back and you realize that, and it's nobody's fault. You either get it or you don't, kind of thing. Like you either realize you live in this coastal city and we have to change the way we do business here because of where we live, or you just don't, you know, you don't think about 50 to 100 years down the road.
There's so many different ways we could go with this that are really, really interesting, because I have noticed, I'm looking at everyone's websites that's running for city council and mayor and all these different local offices, and most people mention flood mitigation or stormwater. And someone commented actually today, I love that you brought that up, because one of the questions that was posed today was, oh, what are they going to do about flooding in the neighborhoods, you know? And I heard something recently that I honestly don't know very much about, but about a big Nemo flood, $10 million flood project on Nemo Parkway that, you know, is kind of being balanced out with teacher raises in the same budget item. And I don't even understand how those things come to be in the same, like, wouldn't they be in totally different budgets and piles of money and things? So, and I don't understand how all of that works. I'm obviously not in that, but, and I don't know if you have any insight into that particular situation, but just generally, is, do you know, as far as the city budgets, is there money that's specifically allocated for storm and flood mitigation and all of that?
There is money allocated, and that's that pile of money that we're 6 years backlogged on.
Okay.
So we don't know where that money went. We don't know why we're 6 years backlogged on that money. But the reality is that, okay, the reality is that we don't have enough money in the world to fix all of the problems that we're going to face with flooding. We don't, because the nature's going to do what it's going to do. But if we redirect funds, if we said, we're not going to do this public-private partnership that cost $100 million over here, we're going to say we're going to reallocate funds, reallocate monies, and focus on building up our public works department, building up our engineering departments, right? And letting those talented people, more of them, assist us so that we catch up on stormwater and start putting in green infrastructure, right? And start working with nature instead of blocking it up with a pump, because it never works at the end of the day, and it's wildly expensive. Well, if we start doing those things, we're going to slowly see mitigation, right? We're going to slowly start seeing it. Now, it's easy to combine the two because everyone's fighting for money. So it's easy to say that $24 million that the school board wants for all day kindergarten, you know, that money should be going over here for flooding. And really, they are two separate. It is two separate issues. And two, but I do believe after COVID, all games are off and the budget's going to be absolutely red penciled and reworked and redistributed. Because I just don't see it happening any other way. There's too many losses.
You have to take something out if you're going to put something else back in. So I don't know how far down the road you want to go, but what kinds of things, you know, if we're, so what are the things that are missing that are keeping us from being able to do that? You mentioned building up the public works department. So is the 6 year backlog because there's not enough people to do the work, or because there's not enough money to pay for it to be done? Because I would imagine if you had the money, you could just hire private companies or contractors or other people to do it. You wouldn't necessarily need to grow the city government necessarily. You could just pay someone to do it if you had the money. I'm sure there are companies in Virginia Beach that clear storm drains, you know.
I don't know. Here's the deal. People have asked that question, Emily. They've asked, like, where did the money go? What is the problem? Where are the shortfalls? And nobody can get a clear answer on why we're 6 years behind, right?
I see.
But we do hire contractors to do a lot of this work. But when I talk about public works and I talk about engineering, what I really mean by that is that we're not hiring the best and the brightest that are coming up now, right? We had a city manager who was an Army Corps of Engineers person, an old school Army Corps of Engineers. Nothing wrong with that. They have a place. His underling was an Army Corps of Engineers. We have a very old school philosophy about infrastructure. And when I say grow that engineering department, I'm saying hire these people that are coming up and let them tell us what we need to do to ensure our 50-year future. But in terms of money, like I said, there's not enough money. Even if we reallocate and rework, we still have to work with the state and federal governments on a daily basis. We have to be very aggressive with grants in order to get this done. And I don't see the effort, right? I see that we have waited and kicked the can down the road so long that now we have no choice but to react.
You mentioned in your campaign website, transparency in government. I'm assuming that goes to part of this. So what would you do if you were on city council to bring more transparency into the process?
I would say that we have to stop our backdoor deals. Like the way, okay, so when I say that is they, city council, the way it's stated now is every time they have something go in front of council, questionable development, for example, they invite the public to go to this meeting, and all these people, 60 people in one case, went up and said, yes, we are against this and we don't want it and blah, blah, blah. And right after it's over, the city council votes for it. Basically, they're checking a box, right? They're saying, yep, here's the public input. We're transparent. When in reality, they already had that deal confirmed before these 60 people show up at city council. That's not in the spirit of transparency. Right? That's checking off a box. And when you watch some of these decisions being made, you know, midway through, this is a waste of time. They've already made up their mind. The fix is in, they're going to vote this way. We have to stop that, because what happens is apathy. At that point, public apathy happens. Oh, well, no, I spent 3 years going in front of city council. And every time I went up there, they didn't listen to me. They don't listen to the residents. They listen to the special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
That is an interesting point, because part of what I'm hoping to do with Smart Citizen is to empower more people to be involved and to show up to those meetings or to be involved in the process. And so I think it is important for people to know that their voices are going to be heard if they're going to take the time to actually go somewhere and be involved, you know, because we have a generation, especially millennials and younger, I think a lot of times people feel like they changed their profile picture so they did something, you know. And I mean, I just put a vote circle on my profile picture and I'm like, woo, did something, you know, but I'm also actively encouraging people to register to vote and trying to give them the information, you know? So I think it can be really easy to feel like, oh, we did something, you know, visible. And so that's meaningful. And I want people to take that next step, you know, get out of your house and go down to the meeting and let people know what you think. Whether it's an issue that I would agree with or not, or, you know, has nothing to do with it. I just want people to be involved in the process because I think it's important. So having that level of transparency and feeling like you're being heard and listened to is really, really important. You also talked about local election reform. Does that tie in at all to the districts and the at-large voting for city council?
Yes, and I didn't know this. I when I moved down here, this is funny. I lived here 10 years before I realized I could vote for every city council person running.
So confusing.
It's very confusing. We're one of two cities that have this hybrid at-large voting system, okay? And I've tried to write down, because every time I get stuck, I'll like write the positives and write, you know what I mean? And I'm sitting there going, oh, you know, I guess you could have an argument either way, because let's say it's all at large and you have the Princess Anne County person, that's their district, but everyone can vote for you, but that's your district. Very often you could lose your district and win the seat.
Right. Yep.
Besides that, your constituents in your district don't think you're the right person for the district.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the negative of the system we have. In my humble opinion, we can keep this one of two ways, but I believe we need term limits. And I believe we need campaign finance reform. And when I put this into perspective for you, the city council makes $27,000 a year annually, right? At $27,000 a year, the mayor makes $30,000. These are part-time jobs for all intents and purposes. There are candidates that have been raising six figures to run for those seats. Mm-hmm. What does that tell you?
I've looked at VPAP. Have you used that? I'll pop it up here on the screen if people want to check it out. it's a really cool site that allows you to look at a lot of the campaign funding. Let me see where it comes from. And so it does add good, I think, valuable transparency into the process. So let's explain that just a little bit for people that might not have the context or fully understand what we're talking about. There's the vpap.org if anybody wants to look that up. So the way that it works in Virginia Beach for both the school board and the city council is that everyone who's up for election, no matter what district they're part of, is listed on the entire ballot, and every single person voting in the entire city can vote for everyone on the ballot. So no matter what district you live in, you can vote for every city council person, every school board person. And I would actually like to hear, and I hope during some of these interviews, if I get to talk to some incumbent city council people that have considered and voted on this, I'd like to hear the pro side, because I don't actually understand what the pro argument of it is. I can see what you just said, that, you know, you could actually live in, say, Rose Hall District, and the majority of people in Rose Hall District vote for candidate A, but the majority of the city votes for candidate B, and you end up not getting the candidate for your district that you wanted, and then people feel underrepresented. And there's actually a lawsuit that's in court right now specifically about this. So I know it's a hot button issue right now. So, and it was voted on recently, right? I believe Jessica Abbott brought it up in the last year or two.
And I didn't know this until recently, but apparently when she was initially elected, okay, that was something that was on her platform. Like,
oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
Right. She didn't get to it. So then recently she put it back in the hopper. Like, she wanted to get it up as a referendum on our ballot this year. And but it got voted down. Yeah. Cause then the public can decide, is this what you want? You know, mm-hmm. Is this how you would like to elect your people? And it got voted down in city council. And the only thing that I can think of about why, and this is it's expensive to run in the whole city. It's very, very expensive. So if you have me, I'm an independent. Let's just start there. I'm an independent. I belong to no party, never have, and I can sleep at night.
Which is kind of interesting, right? I talked to, my last interview was with Matthias Paul Telkamp, who's running for school board, on an openly Democratic platform. And we talked about, I asked him specifically about it, because on the ballot, all of these offices, all city council offices, mayor, and all the school board offices are listed as nonpartisan. And I asked him, you know, what effect do you think it has on these local elections to run on a party platform that's so obvious? Do you think it's helpful, or, you know, affects things at all? And his thought process behind it, which I get, was that he feels like it helps bring clarity for people to understand his position. Be that as it may, that's his position. I'm not trying to take any kind of position here, but I'm just saying it's a fascinating thing to me that I would think then you would want to have it on the ballot. Like, if you're going to say nonpartisan on the ballot, but have people able to run on party platforms, then I would think you would want to have on the ballot what their actual party is, so that people who aren't paying attention and show up know those things. You know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I do. And I can tell you this. It's been nonpartisan for years, and the Republican Party never endorsed previously. Like, this is the first year they created this voter guide, for lack of a
better term. I just saw that a day or two ago for the first time. I hadn't seen it until then.
So they did that because it's a reaction to the Democratic Party, who got very, very involved in local elections and handed out their Democratic Party guide. They vet, and I don't even know who they are. It's a committee, a Democratic committee. We don't know who they are. And they decide which candidates running should be on their ballot. I have a problem with this because what it does is it divides local. It makes it even more divisive on a local level. So So a person who's voting doesn't have to do any work at all. They can just go, oh, I'm a Democrat. Hand me that ballot. I'm going to go down that list. And God knows who vetted these people. What are their qualifications for being on that list? Why aren't all these people not on that list, right? And what I think it does is you owe your party. So now, not only do we have special interest challenges where you owe a special interest and you can't be objective because of that, now locally, you owe your party. You pretty much owe them. So you, if they say, oh, you know, this 2A vote is coming and you must vote that way. Really? You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So even if you don't believe it, you're going to go with your party, even if the public decides they don't want it. And then the other side of that is you're supposed to represent the entire city. If this becomes so partisan that you are alienating 50% of the city, how can you work in their best interest, and how can they have faith in you?
Right. Well, and from what I understand, you know, with both the school board and the city council being nonpartisan, it's meant to be more about the issues in front of you than an agenda one way or another, right? And so I can see the benefit of keeping them nonpartisan, though I get that everyone has their opinions and views, and, you know, we have grown much more polarized as a country. So there's a lot of that happening now, and I get that. But there has to be places we can come together, especially around our cities and our schools and, you know, these places where we live and work and do life, and figure out ways to compromise and work together around those things. And so it's just, it's an interesting thing. Part of why I started Smart Citizen is because of the fact that you can't just party line vote on these local elections. You have to actually do the research to understand who people are. And that information is not easy to find. It's really not easy. I've been trying. It's hard. So now I'm doing live interviews with people to try to find out what their views are, because I'm voting this year myself. You know, I want to know for myself, and I want other people to be able to know. So this is a really interesting conversation. So local election reform, would you try to do what we were just talking about, put a referendum forward, or how is the process for bringing about local election reform? How does that work?
So it starts with city council, and one of the council folks, like Jessica, right? She said, here's my proposal, and they vote. She'll say, I want this to be on the referendum, on the ballot, and the city council will vote and decide whether or not it should be. And it takes 6 votes of the 11 to get something to a referendum, if I'm not mistaken. You have to have a majority. So that's how it works. And so I could do that. And I think I'm in a way glad it didn't get to referendum the way she presented it, because it didn't address term limits, right? It did not address campaign finance. I don't know if it can, you know, it'd be something I'd have to investigate. But if you're going to do it right the first time, right? So that we don't keep running into, oh, well, now we have to change it because of this.
Right. Yeah. You want to wrap everything in. So what type of term limits would you recommend, or would you be going for if you were on city council?
Well, see, in my heart and mind, the governor gets a term, right? The governor gets a term. What I've been told after talking to people is that sometimes you cannot get your goals done in one term. Okay. It might take 2 terms to get your work done and to feel like you accomplished something. I would say no more than 8 years. I think that is absolutely enough time on city council, because what happens with these 20, 30, 40 year council members is you don't get the diversity and inclusion in your city because they're controlling who gets put on boards and commissions, right? Who gets put on the planning commission? Who gets put on the Virginia Beach Development Authority? Those decisions are held close to the chest. And so if you have like minds constantly on those committees, you're not getting any diversity. Mm. You're getting the same people over and over that have your back.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
The you sit there, the longer you are in your position, you become complacent and you become more reliant on special interest donations and more concerned about getting reelected every year than you do about making a decision that is right for the community but makes the special interest mad.
Right. Well, and it's long enough for a president in our national discourse. So city council is a 4-year position. Okay. That's good to know. So it would be 2 elections, and statistically, at least on a national level, it's significantly harder to beat an incumbent just by sheer name recognition. So if you were consistently able to run, your likelihood of being able to consistently win is a lot higher just because of the way it works.
And that's right. What's happening here. Like the incumbent that you know I'm running against is 20 years.
One thing I noticed doing a little digging in CPAP is that, or not CPAP, VPAP, sorry, VPAP, was that companies can donate to candidates, which surprised me a little bit. So is that some of the campaign finance reform? Is that in the, like, what kind of things would you be looking to address with that? Would it be companies or other things?
I just think that if you have a cap, if you have a limit to the amount of monies that you are allowed to take for this position that pays $27,000 a year, right? It levels the playing field because it's shown 9 times out of 10, the more money a person has, the more likely they are to win.
Oh, for sure. Because of advertising dollars, if nothing else.
Yeah. So once again, you are limiting the quality that could potentially be there. So, you know, I've accepted monetary contributions, but they're not from special, and it's from friends that have businesses but not a special group like developers, for example. It's not overabundance of developers, and they are prevalent in this city. There's a lot of monies being spent from developers and their attorneys to, you know, make sure their candidate wins.
Right. Well, and it makes sense if you're trying to develop that you want to make sure the people who are going to help you do that are there. One thing that's interesting when you talk about green infrastructure, can you give some examples, speaking of development, of what type of things that would look like?
Yeah. So one, this is going to sound crazy, but it's not meant to. So in Back Bay, for example, because this is how granular you could get. So in Back Bay, we have a special concern because the wind blows south. So when the wind blows south, the water comes out of the Pamlico Sound and floods Back Bay, okay. The homes and everything in Back Bay. The reason it's flooding now is because we've put down impervious surfaces, concrete. Every patch of concrete that you put down disperses the water. There's nowhere for the water to go. So part of sustainable development or part of green infrastructure is putting down pervious surfaces, porous surfaces, so the water can go through and not puddle up on the roads and stuff. But also in Back Bay, what we're doing to try to slow the wind down, because the bay grasses are gone, we're working with Virginia Tech, a Dr. Sarah Sweeten, and she's created celery that grows in the water and serves as a subaquatic vegetation. And what it will do is slow that blowing over of the bay so that not as much water will hit the earth when it blows out.
Would that look like city regulation on future development or going back and redoing stuff that's already been done?
It is virtually impossible once it's there. So my goal would be to make sure that we're working with developers. I mean, developers are great. I mean, they're brilliant. They're, you know, they have vision, but we're not asking enough of them, in my opinion. Like there are, and it's not cheap to develop sustainably, but even if we take steps, just little baby steps to get more of that sustainable building materials and clean energy that can be incorporated in these new developments, the better off we're going to be. We're just not doing any of it.
That's why I was asking about regulations, because I don't know a ton about this space, but from the little bit I've seen, it seems like there's kind of two approaches, and there may be way more, and it might be more complex than this. So I would love it if you can help me understand. But it seems like one approach is one approach is sort of the stick, and the other is the carrot on the stick. You know, one is kind of like regulation, where it's like you have to do this or you won't be able to do anything. And the other is like incentives, where if you choose to be more sustainable in your development, you get tax breaks or whatever other incentives might be there. What approach would you take as far as greener development?
Incentivize the developer so that he's not taking that much of a hit, but it needs to be managed, right? You can't just, okay, you know, we're gonna public-private partnership you, and you're just gonna go off and do what you want. We need to manage it with our engineers and our engineering department to make sure that what they say they're doing, they're doing. Right. And so I believe in incentivizing. Like, we're trying to get trees put back. You know, when a developer comes in and they say, oh, well, yeah, they're supposed to leave so many trees. But what they do is they take down all the trees and then they put in inferior trees. And I know that sounds crazy, but when you have a full grown tree, a balsam or something like that, it soaks up 11,000 pounds of water a day.
It's a day?
Yeah, it's a crazy.
Wow.
It sucks it up. So when that happens, it's a big tree. Okay.
Right. Like, you find in older neighborhoods or more established areas. You don't find that in new development most of the time. Because the roots get in the way. They soak up all those things. Yeah.
Right. And then they put in a tree that's not going to be doing that. Right.
It's just
not going to be as effective. So what we're doing in Asheville Park, and Barbara Henley, Councilwoman Henley's been involved in this reforestation project. Asheville Park has been a problematic neighborhood since the get-go.
I have friends that live there. I've heard.
It's not their fault. It's true.
Right. No, it's not.
Their fault. They bought into a neighborhood that was not developed properly.
Right.
It just wasn't. And it probably should have never been developed at all, because that was the green line. That was protected space.
Oh,
and
okay.
In 2003, the city council voted to move the green line. So it opened the gates to development, right?
I see.
So it was not a good situation. But they're taking the back acres that the city negotiated to remain green, and they're reforesting it. They're putting in hundreds of trees.
Wow.
For this reason. Because they will soak up that water that's being blown from the Pamlico.
That makes sense.
Okay. Yeah.
That's really cool. There's so many interesting solutions
there
to
are.
These challenges. And if you aren't neck deep in it, so to speak.
Well, sometimes it's a toolkit too, Emily. It's not one thing. Like, it's a toolkit. Trees aren't going to solve the problem.
Right.
But trees are a mitigator. Wetlands are a mitigator. That's why tearing them down is a bad thing. It's not a good idea. Not now.
Figuring out ways to then continue the development that does need to happen, I would imagine, in sustainable ways, because we're obviously a booming city. You know, people are wanting to move here. So what other ways can we find for development to happen that are positive and sustainable? Do you have any ideas down that route?
Yes, because COVID is going to change things for us, period. And I think one of the outcomes is going to be the commercial real estate is not going to be needed as it was prior to COVID, because businesses are figuring out that their work staff can be home.
Right.
And they can meet via Zoom and they can do these things. So why have 5,000 square feet of whatever, right? Mm-hmm. I think that we haven't seen, and we don't know exactly what it's going to look like. But prior to COVID, we have a ton of vacant buildings, box stores and everything else in Virginia Beach. And the impervious surface is already there. So we're not going to be adding more impervious surface, right? So we need to repurpose buildings. We need to creatively, and this is where you incentivize people, creatively repurpose that building that backs into this neighborhood that is now a box store. And let's figure out how to make it a pedestrian, you know, friendly 15-minute bike ride community where you don't even have to get in a car. Mm-hmm. There's ways to do these things. We just are used to sprawl. And we have a challenge building up here because they're always afraid of hurricanes. So we're in a catch 22.
Is that why buildings don't get very tall here?
That's why they were not, like at the oceanfront, there's a height restriction. The military also, if you're
in the water, it was more military related, but
it's also, I think, has to do with potential hurricanes. But you know, that's kind of counterintuitive since Miami's like, what, 80 feet floors high. But we did have military height restrictions here too.
Okay. So I moved here from New York City, and I lived in Charlotte before that. And I grew up in Denver, and Denver has massively boomed. It's insane. It's a totally different place now. Way cooler, way more interesting than it was when I lived there. But they have had a lot of takeover of different warehouse districts and turnover of industrial areas into much more pedestrian friendly. Charlotte, and I voted in my very first election in Denver for a light rail that they established all the way through the city that's now pretty much done and running all over Denver, which is pretty interesting. And they've established different light rail things in Charlotte and marketed it really well in Charlotte. And then obviously I lived in New York City where there was tremendous public transit everywhere. I didn't have a car in New York. And for 4 years that I lived there, and you know, just went everywhere on buses and trains and walked and did everything. And I moved here and didn't have a car for 9 months.
You were probably like, oh my God.
I was just like totally trapped if people didn't give me rides, you know? So I'm curious if you have any, and I'm not even necessarily advocating for one way or the other myself for light rail here, because I feel like that's a very complex situation. I would like to know your opinion on the light rail, but just public transit in general. I mean, if you're looking at sustainability, I feel like we have, from an outsider's observance, a pretty poor public transit, at least accessibility situation here. If you're coming from a sustainability perspective, I'm curious to hear, you know, what's your thought in terms of public transit? Do you think we need it? Do you think it's done well? Could be done better? Do we not need it? You know, what's your perspective on it?
All right. I do think we need to modify what we have. Without a doubt, we need to modify it. The bus stops are not even maintained properly. You know, they're just overgrown. It's not even a really good situation for people who have to take the bus.
Right.
We have talked, I know the city leaders have also talked about a modified system that might be electric transit cars, you know, or buses, or smaller buses that are far more mobile, that have specific stops, you know, almost like a school bus.
There's smaller transit vans and things you can catch on routes.
And also even work with privatizing, like working with the Ubers and the Lyfts and getting a more cohesive relationship with that those services.
Okay.
But I was reading a really great article the other day because it is a sustainable thing. And because we created our city where every neighborhood was supposed to stand alone, right? Like if you look at it, it's really weird. So you've got Kempsville, right? Then you've got Lagomar, and you've got all these little neighborhoods that you come out of the neighborhood and you're on like Virginia Beach Boulevard. You're on like a busy
big street.
So one thing that I was reading about was that seriously called a 15-minute city, right? Where you now take it one step further and you put bike paths in that neighborhood. So that neighborhood is all connected, right? Mm-hmm. So you start internally, you put some commercial, careful commercial, maybe out of repurposed buildings, right? You get mm-hmm. creative on the outskirts of that community. And then before you know it, you have a city within a city, right? Mm-hmm. And then you connect the next city. You know what I mean? You connect mm-hmm. the next neighborhood, and then you connect
like hubs.
Hubs. And what it'll do if done right, like town center, you literally don't need a car if you can live and work there. And you could shop there. Vibe District.
I don't know. I lived off 24th and Baltic before. I love that area.
It's fantastic because it was, I hate to say this, it was run down, old buildings. It's
really been transformed.
Yeah, very much so. Still have work to do, but they've created a very culturally diverse live, work, play community mm-hmm. where you don't need a car. If mm-hmm. you're lucky enough to make that work for you, right?
Right.
So if we just focus on those tactics throughout the city, we're going to slowly fix this transportation issue. And then the only other way to fix it completely is to work regionally with Norfolk, because everyone is melding in and out of here. So we're never going to fully get away from the interstate. It's never going to happen.
Of course.
Still going to have it, but we can cut it down and improve people's qualities of life. If we could modify, if we could have more town center-esque, more vibe-esque mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm.
I saw the city of Norfolk put out is taking bids for revitalizing Military Circle.
Yeah. Yes.
Which is exciting. It sounded like they were looking for sounded really amazing, you know, and I thought, oh, those are the kinds of things I've been waiting to see here, you know. Yeah. Which
exactly.
is
what we're talking about right now. Mm-hmm. They want sustainability was a word. They a mm-hmm. mixed use situation, and all those people never have to leave there.
Right.
You know what I mean, in a perfect world.
I don't know the exact details on this, but one of the reasons that I heard that the light rail has been voted down had to do with the fact that it's so highly subsidized by the city. Is that right? It's like one of them, it costs the city a lot of money for everybody who rides it.
Right. So they based it on Norfolk's version of the light rail that doesn't make any money.
Right.
So it's basically a loss leader.
and so it doesn't make sense to extend it because of that?
Well, I'm not sure about all the politics that went into the decision not to do light rail, but what I do know is that light rail in and of itself is already an outdated rail system. Okay. And it also, because we, and I always think about this, because we have these flooding issues, it's not even wise, you know, to put that cart before the horse about making sure that we don't destroy it with floodwaters. Like you,
I mean, if you build this I'm sure it would be billions of dollars to build a light rail that actually extended far enough.
Yeah, I mean, but I think it is a lost leader, and I think every city, and we don't hear about that because it's such a fabric of those communities that we're not hearing about it being a drain on the budget, but it would be. And I don't think we're in a position, well, we certainly are not in the position now to take that back on, I don't think, financially. But we have to modify what we have, Emily.
Absolutely. There has to be more options. For people that don't have access to vehicles, you know,
or that need to get to work. They need to get to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And God forbid you have a flood where your car gets flooded out and you're not in a job that you can work remotely. Yeah. You know, you just hope that you have good friends. And I think a lot of people here, there's two groups of people here, right? There's the people that grew up here and have lived here like yourself for a really, really long time. And there's the people who are more transient. I've been here for almost 4 years. So I'm sort of still in the new category, but I'm making my way over. And a lot of my good friends are people who've grown up here forever. And it's, you know, you don't always realize, I think, if you've been here for a long time, that not everyone knows their way around or knows how to find things or understands the challenges that are facing the city or why certain things are done a certain way. So it's really helpful to get perspective from people who've been here for a bit longer and understand, you know, the thinking behind, you know, maybe different issues why light rail or some of those things wouldn't go through, because it's highly complex, obviously.
It's complex, and it got very political, I think, too. So there was like a lot, a lot that went into that whole situation. But in my mind, being a fiscal conservative that I am, I think it's an expense that we don't need right now because we don't have our foundation straight. And until we get that foundation straight, any money we just keep throwing at ourselves is a waste of money. Because if we don't deal with the flooding, our housing values are going to go down. People will leave here.
Right.
Period. And that's going to happen.
So let me ask you one more hot button budgetary issue, since that seems to be the topic of the night. So I think until this year, most people didn't know the level of influence that city councils have on generally. They just didn't know the level of influence that city councils have, but especially on budgets and things like police department budgets, those sort of things. And you mentioned on your website that you support police and first responders. So what does that support mean to you, and how would that influence your role on city council, or, you know, as some of these budgetary things are being worked on?
I was in line today working at the poll station, and this woman came up to me. She goes, "I read about you. I just have a question." And it was about support of the police. And so I have to tell you that when I heard defund the police, right? When I heard that, I'm like, oh my gosh, what does that mean? And so I, because this is how I am, Google it.
Good.
Well, I mean, because everyone else is like, oh, they mean take it, you know, they were right. All over the bridge. So I look at it and I'm like, okay. And I'm also a marketer. So I thought to myself, what they're doing is they're throwing the worst possible scenario out there to get the conversation started. This is how I looked at it. And I think that the conversation got started. And as much as I support the police, what this whole thing showed me is that there are biases in our society. And there are biases, and we have created a situation for our police where we've militarized them, right? And how can you protect and serve when that's your stance, like the Navy SEALs? Like, you know what I'm trying to say? We basically turn them into militia mentally. What I think about this whole thing is that our police are overworked and underpaid. I really believe that they are underpaid for putting themselves in these dangerous positions every day. And I don't think that they get the support. This is generally getting the emotional support that they need. I mean, they see things in a week that we may never see in our whole lifetime. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell me that it's not affecting their thought process and their clarity, right? Even though they're trained, you can't underestimate that. And they're a brotherhood, sisterhood, so they might be afraid to say, "I need help," right? So I look at this whole awakening as an opportunity to make it better and support them so that they are put in a position to protect and serve. And when I was growing up, and I grew up in an inner city in upstate New York, so it wasn't New York City, but it was in upstate New York, and the police were part of our life. Mm-hmm. Like, they were in our neighborhoods. They literally were there. And if we were going sideways, they knew before our parents knew we were going sideways. You know what I mean? So they were friends. They were like, so when I started seeing all this stuff on the news, because it didn't affect me, right? Mm-hmm. I was mortified. And I looked at it two ways. We have to fix the bias, or we have to educate and act on any bias that may exist. And I don't believe vilifying the entire group of people is fair. Mm-hmm. I think that it's very sad that we've done that to our police. We've vilified them, right? To the point where they're walking off the job.
Right.
But I do think that what it did is shed light that there's good, bad, and ugly in every walk of life. Mm-hmm. And we need to make that department and that service better for them and the people that they serve. And I think it's a conversation. It's a conversation that is transparent and open, where everyone feels comfortable having it and they don't take it personally. So I'm not about defunding at all. As a matter of fact, I'm the opposite. I say now is the opportunity to pay them fairly. That's how I feel about that. And to, you know, training, ongoing training, and weed out any negativity that might exist in the department. Mm. To answer your question, it's not an easy one. It's not, it's complicated because these are people's livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And they sign up for a job and they probably have a sheet, a checklist. You have to get this many quotas and you have to do this. And you, here's your check marks of all the things to do. You lose sight of what you're supposed to do when you're trying to just keep your job. You know what I mean?
Like, especially if you're stressed, you know, which I think is an interesting point that you made about being stressed and overworked and the challenge of asking for help. I think over the last few years, there's been, I think, a good, healthy, ongoing conversation that's been happening around the military with, you know, similar kind of dynamics where it's hopefully, I think in our culture and society as a whole, asking for help and admitting that you need help in certain areas is becoming much more culturally acceptable. Where I have friends now that will openly talk about, you know, oh, I went to see my therapist and blah, blah, blah. And it's not like a joke, you know, they're saying, oh, I learned this thing that was really helpful. Let me share it with you or whatever. And it's becoming a lot more part of our dialogue as a culture that I think is awesome.
Yeah.
And so I think as that opens up more in the whole broader culture, and then you can have people in these specialized positions and areas and things that can get the help that they need. That would be really vital.
I just think that if they're put in a position and they're already highly stressed out and they're in the, there's room for error always. And sadly, there seems to be a bias that when you're in that position, you lose your rational thought for whatever reason. It's probably been going on since the beginning of time. So now is the time. We all can be better, you know? Mm-hmm. That's how mm-hmm. I feel. Like, we all need to be better, and we all need to continue to learn, and we all need to recognize that we all have our own bias, whether it's women, men, minorities, people of color, whatever it is, we carry bias with us. And we have to recognize that.
And deal with it so we can grow.
Yeah.
So just to wrap up here, because we're getting close on time, I would love to hear, because we're trying to help people understand more about government, how it works, you know, city council. So what's one thing that you wish that everybody knew or understood about city council that you think is misunderstood or unknown right now?
I think sometimes we put the blame for everything bad on this group of people that don't control decisions that our governor makes, right?
Right.
But people don't, oh my gosh, you know, you guys, you need to do this and that. Well, we're a Dillon rule state, first of all. And I don't know if you recognize that, Emily, mm-hmm. but we don't override the governors. They take precedent. So we can't override.
Okay.
So when the governor makes a mandate that you will wear masks, that's what you're going to do in Virginia. Right. Okay. So I think that people need to understand that our purview on a local level is truly local. It's local budgeting. It's anything that has to do with amendment rights, like the Second Amendment and all of that, that's all handled in Richmond and federally. All we do is carry out those mandates. We can make decisions about whether or not we allow our public buildings to be concealed carry or not. That's about as much as we're going to touch a national topic like that.
Okay.
So I think it's important for a few folks to understand that our purview is stormwater, property taxes, schools. It's all the stuff that affects people on a daily basis. And that's why the partisan stuff is killing. It bothers me because nobody cares about whether you're an R or a D when your storm drain is getting cleaned out. Like, they don't care. Just clean it out. Right. You know, I'm paying my property tax. I don't care if the lady collecting the check is an R or a D. None of the stuff that we're dealing with has anything to do with partisan politics on a daily basis.
Right. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. So lastly, what do you think is one thing you would like people to know or remember about you specifically as they're going to the polls this year?
Oh, I appreciate you asking that, Emily. I think what I would love for people to know is that my heart is absolutely in the right place. I would never be doing this if it wasn't. I really believe in my heart of hearts that if we do not act as a city and a region where coastal resiliency is concerned, that we are going to pay the price. Actually, Emily, you are, right? And my son is.
Right.
I'm not going to be here to worry about it. And what's going to happen is if we don't, we are going to face a housing situation. We're going to face people leaving here and moving elsewhere because they can't afford the flood insurance and whatever else is coming down the pike. So this is not, to me, anything to sneeze at. And it infuriates me every time city council sees a shiny new project, you know, and that's where the focus is when we have not fixed Windsor Woods yet. And that was in 2016 when that happened. And they're still flooding every time it rains. So I just want people to understand that I'm not speaking about flooding for an election, that I am actively involved in this issue 52 weeks a year. That's
excellent.
It.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Nadine. If you want to find out more about her campaign, you can check out nadine4vb.com. If you're watching, it's up on the screen. And quick reminder, everyone, don't forget to register to vote by October 13th. I'm going to keep putting it out there because I don't want anyone to miss their opportunity. And there's only a few days left. So make sure you do it. Even if you don't know if you want to vote yet, at least give yourself the opportunity to make up your mind by registering to vote. And follow Smart Citizen on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Smart Citizen USA. We streamed this today live on Facebook, and we'll have some segments up on IGTV later this week as soon as I'm able to get them up there. And hopefully we'll be able to keep bringing more information. Nadine, I really enjoyed speaking with you today. Thank you so much for the lively conversation, and I wish you the best of luck this November.
Thank you. I wish you success too, Emily. Congrats.